trying to make a kind of a public speech or a comment on public affairs in a way. So we've assembled where different people are delegates of different things, and the also how to get the bearings of the situation. We're not really in a booth, but it's kind of like a booth. We're in a fair. We're clearly in a marketplace. It's not a public space, or is it? Today's the VIP day. And so, how am I here? So I have a gallery that I worked with from London, they're here. Gallery I worked with from Amsterdam, they're here. So I thought of this story that connects Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. In Amsterdam, there's a cultural institution that's not represented here, which is this great bookstore called Bookie Wookie. And Bookie Wookie, it's not really a bookstore because it's not, the purpose of it is not to make money as a business. It's really more like a project space for artist books. And they're connected to the, in some ways, to this German artist Diderot. And so when Hauser & Wirth London took over the Diderot estate, they invited Bookie Wookie to come to London and make a little bookshop in the exhibition space. And then after the exhibition closed, they invited Bookie Wookie to stay in London and become the permanent bookstore of Hauser & Wirth London, which is at the intersection between a kind of a self-organized hippie world and a very big commercial art world, is an interesting juxtaposition. And so when the guy from Bookie Wookie told me about that, I was really impressed. And I said, oh, so you're going to do it? And he said, well, no, of course not. And I was really surprised. I said, well, how could you turn that down? And he said, well, I just think I would go crazy. And then he sort of went on to explain the different ideas he had about the art world. And at one point we started talking about, it's not really a fair, but in Berlin they have something similar to a fair, which is they have a gallery weekend. And it's the first weekend in May, generally. And so all of the galleries make a special program, and then they invite collectors from all over the world. In one year, the gallery weekend, the VIP launch of the gallery weekend was on May 1st, which is also the traditional day of the workers, which in Berlin, there's a tradition of having a riot on that day. And so I had to think, and I was discussing this with the guy from Bookie Wookie, I was like, well, do you think that they... was the person who scheduled the art fair to coincide with the riot, were they oblivious to that? Or did they forget? Did it not seem important? And you have to have this image of the kind of the VIP fleet of BMWs and Audis going through the streets and the burning tires and the police and the tear gas and the two of these things coinciding. And the guy from Bookie Wookie, he kind of went up to me. He thought that the people who organized the art fair thought it was a good idea and that they had done it on purpose because it had a certain kind of poetics to it. And then, and I was like, wow, you really think someone would be so cynical? And then he said something which wasn't so cynical. He said, well, you know, actually that's what art always has been. Art has always been this place where the people in the VIP BMW fleets meet the people who want to burn tires. And that space is the space we have to work with. And that was his idea. I think that's probably one of the most optimistic readings of the contemporary situation. I'm going to talk a little bit about this project that I worked on last year. I had this idea that somehow Hannah Arendt could be relevant for contemporary art in a way that no one really was working on yet. And I think it's because, for me, the reason Hannah Arendt is maybe more important than other thinkers is that Hannah Arendt, in her work, has a defense for politics not as a means-ends equation, not just as a goal of where we want to get to, but as a means in and of itself. And for anyone who was involved, for instance, in politics around culture in the Netherlands in June, or even now, if you were thinking of it as a means-ends equation, if the only point of being involved was to get the result you wanted, it's a profoundly frustrating and discouraging process. Because the experiences of losing continually. And I think that one of the things that focusing on the practice of struggle and the principle of struggle and organizing as a kind of engagement, the principle of engagement, even on a mental level, that has something to offer, not just practically, but also towards restoring the dignity of trying to be involved in things like that in the first place. So that's part of the big, big interest that I have in Hannah Arendt's work. And Hannah Arendt's connection to culture is really, really, in one way, really modest. She didn't ever really write about visual arts. There's just this one essay that's explicitly about culture. And I saw that the anniversary of the essay was coming up, and I was sort of opportunistically thought that I would use it as this occasion to do something. I thought to try and make a modest but ambitious intervention. So I did a series of reading groups and seminars and a lecture series. First a two-day seminar in London, then a weekly series in Berlin in May, and then this fall in Amsterdam. And then we'll sort of conclude this spring in Amsterdam. And I could go into details about the lecture, or about the Arendt's essays, but I think it doesn't feel like the time or the place. So I'm just going to focus on sort of what the results have been, the tentative results. One of the first results was that in June, after finishing this series in May, when I was in a program from If I Can't Dance, If I Can't Dance, I Don't Want to Be Part of Your Revolution, in Gdansk in Poland. And Marcel from If I Can't Dance was the first person I had met who seemed as totally freaked out about the impending budget announcement as I thought everyone should be. And then I thought maybe something was wrong for me for assuming that people should be freaked out. But he was really legitimately totally freaked out about it in a very honest and constructive way. He took it deadly seriously, and I think that was totally appropriate. And so after I met with him in Gdansk, and then when the announcement was made, thinking about all this kind of more abstract theoretical work I had been doing, I started trying to write about it. And I wrote about it, and I sent it to some people, and they said, oh, you should try and make this letter. And then it got kind of cooked through a lot of other people's ideas, and ultimately became a little argumentative nugget, which I will read, which was then co-signed, and then at one point it was read in a few different contexts, once at Apple, once in front of the Van Gogh Museum. So I'll read the letter that was put out. 50 years ago, against the backdrop of war and a growing consumer society, Hannah Arendt wrote, The Crisis in Culture, Its Social and Its Political Significance. Seeing the cultural realm disappearing, Arendt sought to defend it on the grounds that culture, through the practice of honoring the past and present to preserve our judgment and taste, offered the capacity for an enlarged mentality, to see the world through another's eyes, and so to build up the imagination and the capacity to think. For Arendt, this was strengthening the foundation of public life. She believed it was precisely the absence of this foundation, thinking in the place of another, that allowed totalitarianism to take over so much of Europe, to permit people to turn in their neighbors and cities everywhere, and so to plunge the civilized world into barbarism. This argument is not new. In fact, the entire European post-war framework, a humanism defined by commitment to liberty, social justice, and vibrant public life, was guided by this fundamentally conservative insight. This was precisely the rationale for the now established tradition of public support for culture from all over Western Europe. From this perspective, the recent attack on public support for culture in the Netherlands, while often seen as coming from the right, is certainly not conservative. While the planned financial cuts are severe, the ideological cut is far deeper. Terms from management and marketplace cannot obscure that what is being attacked, what is being abandoned, are the lived traditions and practices, the guiding principles of post-war European humanism. Given that the Netherlands has historically been a leader in this project, for an active participant in the European and Dutch cultural life to see this anti-conservative program gaining momentum is confusing. The idea that this could be done in response to a relatively minor budget problem and in the name of the public good is radical. as the Archbishop of England recently commented, to use budgetary policy as a cover for ideological changes to national institutions is fundamentally undemocratic. The contemporary cultural realm of the Netherlands might have many failures and wants, but this space of living practice is one of the crucial stages for raising questions and critical reflections in a public realm threatened with the loss of thinking and judgment, or in the case of recent debates on immigration, the capacity to see the world through someone else's eyes, especially when they are our neighbors. At the time of this writing, those who practice and support culture have been roused in anticipation of imminent plans to withdraw public support. It is constructed to defend cultural space, good working conditions, even particular institutions. But it's crucial to put these issues into broader context. The withdrawal of public support is not a matter of fiscal priorities or shared sacrifice, but an attack on tradition. Public institutions of all sizes dedicated primarily to culture are in turn some of the foremost organs of contemporary civil society and the true anchor of public life. It is barbaric to justify their destruction in the name of the public good, for no public good could be served by this attack. So that's a long-winded way of trying to focus on a simple recognition, which would be that some of the underlying structures that underpin, if you take a step back and you look at the public policy priorities that would lead towards funding something like the Mondrian Foundation or Documenta or Sculpture in Munster, that those public policy perspectives and the affirmative argument that is taken for granted, that those affirmative arguments can no longer be taken for granted. And in this way, one of the secondary discoveries is that the traditional, or what has now become for us the traditional left-wing critique of contemporary art, is not particularly useful. So for Benjamin Buchlow to go to Sculpture in Munster and say that Sculpture in Munster is entertainment for the West German bourgeois, in fact, fuels the argument that Sculpture in Munster should not be given public policy priority because it is actually just another form of entertainment, like a shopping mall or a bowling alley. Why? It's a very, very expensive bowling alley. I mean, Documenta is a very expensive bowling alley if it's only a question of entertainment. The broader humanistic questions, which used to be understood, are no longer understood. And I don't think that this is only true in culture. I think that you could say that when the demonization of immigrants and on the basis of their religion is then extended to, for instance, socialists in Greece, that something is unraveling that is very foundational. And this is why it was very important that Marcel in Poland was freaking out, because it was totally appropriate to become hysterical. And not that he was hysterical, but that's an appropriate response. And so that's why it's difficult in some ways to maintain a kind of a measured tone about things that are quite serious. And so what to do then when this old hokey language of humanism and of culture's relationship to the public good needs to be reappraised, not just as some kind of a philosophical practice, but as a kind of a matter of self-defense, actually. That I don't know. I mean, it was just my recognition that that was an issue. And it reveals certain things to me. I mean, one of the things was in one of the reading groups in Amsterdam was I tried to describe the difference between the Whitney Biennial and Sculpture in Munster. If you take a big step back, and a lot of people wouldn't see the difference, that there is a fundamental distinction to be made between contemporary art as a form of fashion and novelty and contemporary art as a form of a contribution to civil society. And the idea that people's tax money should go to funding contemporary artists to try and contribute to civil society is something that doesn't happen in the United States. It used to happen. I mean, it was part of our assumption that the structure of society into the 70s, but Reagan took all that away. And what's interesting is that all of it went away and no one really even remembers it. So you could imagine that all of these things like Sculpture and Munster, Manifesta, Sansbeek, Documenta, that all these things would be gone in the new structurally adjusted Western Europe, and no one would even really notice, because in the meantime everyone would be so busy scrambling just to save their own position. And the scrambling to save one's own position is unavoidable, and is something that, another lesson that came out of Holland in June was that the tendency to scramble to save one's own position is hard to avoid, and is quite makes it difficult to get things done. The other insight that came out of working on this text for such a long time is a little bit, I don't know, it's different, was the question of, well, is there an affirmative argument for art within Hannah Arendt's work? Because in this text, the Crisis of Culture text, it's mostly negative. It's a mostly negative attack on different ways of instrumentalizing art. So the best example she uses is, like, she says, well, you could use art for education, or you could use art for, you know, trying to raise yourself in society, but that's sort of like using a painting to cover a hole in a wall. You can use a painting to cover a hole in a wall, but you realize that that's not actually the right way to be dealing with a painting. And so Arendt actually asserts that there is a right way to deal with painting. But the essay doesn't really elaborate so much what that right way is in Arendt's point of view. So in order to get at it, I had to look at this other text, which is actually the introduction to the essay that I was interested in. And in that other text, she focuses heavily on this poet named René Char. And in order to sort of preserve the disruption of René Char's work, I actually won't really introduce it. I'm just going to read some of it. But I'll explain that the book that she's interested in was a book that is a collection. So René Char was a surrealist poet who then fought in the French Resistance. And there's a book of his notes from his period of fighting in the Resistance, which is what Arendt is mostly interested in. I am not afraid. I am only dizzy. I must reduce the distance between the enemy and me. Confront him horizontally. At all the meals we take in common, we invite freedom to sit down. The chair remains empty, but the place continues to be set. Horrible day. I was present some 100 meters away at B's execution. I had only to pull the trigger on the machine gun and he was saved. We were on the heights overlooking Suresnes with weapons enough to break the bushes equal in number to the SS. They, unaware of the fact that we were there, to the eyes everywhere around me that begged for the signal to open fire, I responded no with a shake of the head. The June sun slid a polar cold into my bones. He fell as though he didn't even see his executioners, and so light it seemed to me that the least puff of wind must have lifted him off the earth. I did not give the signal because this village had to be spared at any price. What is a village? A village like any other? Did he perhaps know in that last instant? In our shadows, there is not one space alone for beauty. The whole space is for beauty. So now I'll read some of Arendt working on the text. Notre héritage n'est ce précédé de, I can't read French, d'aucun testament. Our inheritance was left to us by no testament. This is perhaps the strangest of the strangely abrupt aphorisms into which René Char, French poet and writer, compressed the gist of what 4 years in the resistance had come to mean. Thus, without premonition and probably against their conscious inclinations, they had come to constitute willy-nilly a public realm where, without the paraphernalia of officialdom and hidden from the eyes of friend and foe, all relevant business in the affairs of the country was transacted in deed and word. It did not last long. After a few short years, they were liberated from what they had originally thought to be a burden, and thrown back into what they now knew to be the weightless irrelevance of their personal affairs, once more separated from that world of reality by an épaisseur triste, the sad opaqueness of a private life centered on nothing but itself. And if they refused to go back to their very beginnings, to their most indigent behavior, they could only return to the old empty strife of conflicting ideologies, which after the defeat of the common enemy once more occupied the political arena, to split the former comrades in arms into innumerable cliques which were not even factions, and to engage them in endless polemics and intrigues of a paper war. What Shar had foreseen, clearly anticipated, while the real fight was still on, quote, "If I survive, I know that I shall have to break with the aroma of these essential years, silently reject, not repress, my treasure," unquote. This had happened. They had lost their treasure. What was this treasure? As they themselves understood it, it seems to have consisted, as it were, of two interconnected parts. They had discovered that he who, quote, joined the resistance found himself, unquote, that he seemed to be, quote, in quest of himself without mastery and naked unsatisfaction, unquote, that he no longer suspected himself of insincerity, of being, quote, carping, suspicious actor of life, that he could afford, quote, to go naked, unquote. In this nakedness, stripped of all masks, of those which society assigns to its members, as well as those which individuals fabricate for himself in his psychological reactions against society, they had been visited for the first time in their lives by an apparition of freedom. Not to be sure because they acted against tyranny and things worse than tyranny, this was true for every soldier in the Allied armies, but because they had become, quote, challengers, unquote, had taken the initiative upon themselves and therefore, without knowing or even noticing it, had begun to create that public space between themselves where freedom could appear. At every meal that we eat together, freedom is invited to sit down. The chair remains vacant, but the place is set. So I would say that in this passage, kind of if you dig it out a little bit, we have within it the way that Hannah Arendt would propose art relate to public life. We have that the work of art exists central to the understanding of the historical event. So in fact, the meaning of the historical event is understood through the artwork, which gives the art and art practice a position of prominence and centrality that I think is quite different from any of the critics in the Frankfurt School. And what did we have with René Char? We have a mixture of these kind of denotative musings and connotative abstract, open-ended, explicit versus oblique. And the way that I tried to summarize this insight about what René Char was doing and how I felt like it relates to, I guess, what I want to try and do mostly, is that René Char ultimately, right, he's not making a critique of Nazi graphic design. So he is not looking at the language of the people who he knows he is in opposition to and critiquing their method of communication. It's not a critical position. It's not a based on reflection. If it's about reflection, it's about reflecting upon one's own circumstances and the circumstances of a lived experience of struggle. And what's weird is that in this way, Arendt's aesthetic starts to then reconnect back to some elements that are familiar to us, particularly that of Walter Benjamin. So in Walter Benjamin's The Author as Producer, he argues, where he points out in this famous example of this Russian writer who left writing theater plays in Moscow to go work with the farmers. Tretiakov distinguishes the operative writer from one who gives information. His mission is not to report, but to struggle. He does not play the role of a spectator, but actively intervenes. So this process of art making in a process of intervention or in a process of struggle is really different than our history of the avant-garde. It's really different from the idea that politics has to do with critical reflections on the conventions of the bourgeois frame or institutional critique. It's not so disconnected from things like the documentary turn. In some ways, it's more, I think it's closer to something like Bob Marley than it is like Michael Asher, or closer to Raymond Pettibone than Michael Asher in a way. So Raymond Pettibone becomes the political artist for Hannah Arendt. It's, you know, dealing with one's own very limited, compromised situation, banging one's head against the wall of your own reality. I don't know how to summarize the project because it's not done yet. I guess in thinking about being here, one insight is that I think we are, in general, too easy to appropriate in our desire to access the public realm, maybe we appropriate some of the trappings of the public realm, like the rhetoric and the language and the imagery, like the Court Caucus where we once were, or the Dutch Assembly. And it would also have been interesting for the Mondrian Fund to spend some money to actually assemble the people in Holland, to actually assemble them to speak to each other and figure out what it would mean to move forward under the very, very changed circumstances that are going to happen a year from now. That would be very concrete and not very, it would be difficult to actually to invest energy in planning. I mean, you heard a lot the word solidarity, but solidarity as a word is pretty meaningless. As a practice, it's very difficult and complicated. Someone pointed out to me recently that in labor struggles on the factory floor, one of the tactics of management to break up solidarity is to pick one or two of the laborers out who are exceptional as possible leaders of the struggle and give them positions in management. And that's a way of breaking up the condition and of blocking and obscuring the actual concrete situation. And you could see that also, I felt like you could see that this summer, that one of the things that came up over and over again, I mean, there was at one moment this language, someone protested by saying, you don't cure the patient by amputating, was a sentence that was printed. And it assumed from the outset that there was a problem, and it proposed that the position of the museum director or the museum was to somehow be involved in reform, whereas what was necessary at that point was for somebody to defend the status quo, actually, and say, you know, on a lot of different levels, this situation is working quite well and should be defended. I guess in conclusion, the only other observations I had were that when I started trying to defend the status quo of the Netherlands, to people outside of the Netherlands, some people didn't agree. And there were two critiques I heard. What I was defending it on a kind of a humanistic level, just like the amount of personal suffering caused by this withdrawal of public support for culture. And someone said to me, well, one critique was an aesthetic critique, that the Netherlands had created its own aesthetic, that was disconnected from an other aesthetic, a broader aesthetic dialogue. It was its own bubble reality, and that was a problem. And then the other critique was, well, why defend? I mean, it was hard for me to understand this, so it's hard for me to put it into words. Why defend? If you only, well, somehow it was like, you should defend everybody. You shouldn't just defend this limited group of people who are going to suffer. And that maybe is the most important part. In reflection, one of the things I didn't know during the protests in June was that right before all the artists went to protest, all of the tank drivers had gone, so all the people who drive tanks, because they got rid of the tanks. And if you think about what it means to get rid of the tanks for the Netherlands, it means giving up a whole 100-year concept of security in relationship to Germany. I mean, it's a very deep thing within the center of the state to give up the tanks. And then all these tank drivers go and they protest, and then we all follow them. And who are we if we don't, if there isn't any sense of how to recognize the common situation with the tank drivers, or at least to be involved in a discussion with the tank drivers, and to recognize that there are, that the question of the public good is not something that we can for very long opportunistically access whenever it is convenient for us. That the question of the public good actually, even out of self-defense, is something that has to be rethought through in a more serious and substantial way. And the difference that we have over the tank drivers over the 14-year-old girls who get attacked for wearing headscarves is that we're pretty self-conscious and reflective as a community. So in theory, we would have that advantage. So maybe in this way, we actually do have something to offer.
Yeah. does anybody have any comments or questions? Well, I have a question. Jeremiah, I wonder to what degree, as an American artist, having had experience of the American education system, how has that enabled you to perhaps to articulate something within this debate in the Netherlands that maybe an artist from a different background would not be able to see so clearly or so indirectly, perhaps?
Well, the first year I was at the Rijksacademie, there was already discussion of some budget cuts, and so our friend asked me to speak about it, and the example that came to mind then, which still counts, is in a small town in the north of Holland, there's an earthwork by Robert Smithson that's very well preserved, and it's been very well preserved since Smithson made it. And there's not much fanfare. There's not. I don't think there's any national institution. It's preserved by the local city, and they spend money every year to keep it looking more or less the way Smithson intended. And it's been embraced by the business that it's a piece in a quarry in this town called Emmen, and the business that runs the quarry has taken some image from the piece and used it as part of their publicity, but not really as like an advertising thing, because no one, how can you cash in on that? It's more of a sort of a sentimental thing. And then if you could compare that to then Spiral Jetty in Utah, which was funded by the Dia Foundation, but then basically abandoned until recently. So, and I think you could extend it. I mean, maybe 10 of the most important earthworks in the world are in the Netherlands. Maybe 15, maybe half of the most important earthworks ever made are in the Netherlands. So there was something in the Netherlands, and also in Belgium, of course, I mean, if you look at the support offered to Gordon Matta-Clark, there was something there which is not there anymore as an underlying understanding of the importance of these things. And later, I guess, Costco will be speaking. Can Altay, the Turkish artist, had a show at Costco last year which dealt with the sheer quantity of sculpture in the city of Utrecht and where it came from and what was behind the kind of the public policy thinking about it. And it's, maybe public policy is a stupid way to put it, that, you know, the how on earth did people think art was for the public good then, and why do we no longer have access to that way of thinking? And what do we do in the place of that? So in that sense, because, I mean, my mother would say, to your question, my mother would say, well, is that she thanks God for the Netherlands all the time. Because there was, when I was living in Los Angeles and making videos about gentrification in Los Angeles, there was not a lot of interest in my work. There was, I mean, really, like, there was, you know, making pieces, I did this festival about the anniversary of the LA riots. You know, no one's interested. It's not that no one, it's like, it wasn't even covered in the papers. Like, they didn't even list it. So the whole cultural discussion is so linked to fashion, entertainment, novelty, that this dimension of where it's assumed that an exhibition like Documenta has something to say to people about the world that we're in, even, of course, it's incredibly compromised, but that whole attitude isn't really there. And that's why certain artists like Raymond Pettibone or Alan Sekula or all those American artists are far more known in Europe and than they are in the United States. I mean, so it's a very weird situation, I think, for American artists to be producing this work that won't, like the Paul McCarthy work with Osama bin Laden in it, I don't think will ever get shown in the United States. I don't think anyone will ever show it. And no one will ever say that that's censorship either. No one will make a case for it, like they say that there's censorship in Turkey or China. No one will ever say, oh, America has censorship too. But in practice, it means that there's no openness, there's no window for that work to be presented, because no one would be willing to take the heat.